LeBron's had his best performances on the road throughout the course of his career, and he said he prefers playing on the road. As much as he loves the Cleveland fans, as much as he loves the home court advantage, that adversity gets the most out of him. And Tyronn Lue said he prefers actually to start a series on the road as well, because it's a feel-out game, and the home team has the pressure to protect that home court. And if you can steal that one, you change the entire series.
We put in a lot of work, you know, these last few days, and it's exciting for us to get back on the court. We're playing against a worthy opponent, great coaching staff, great players, and we look forward to the challenge. You know, the Celtics is our next opponent, and like I said, they're a worthy opponent. We have the game plan, what they bring to the table. We have to mentally focus on our challenges that we have every game. You know, we've been off, it'll be 10 days tomorrow, you know, since we played a game. The rhythm is something that you kind of like, you know, see if we still have it. But as far as the mental side, we're mentally focused.
If you're Isaiah Thomas, you could do some damage in a series like this, because Kyrie Irving is going to kill you with his offense. Even though he can play defense, he's not a stout defender. And as a result, you're going to find pick and roll situations where the Channing Frye's and Kevin Love's of the world are going to find themselves defending some of these guards. With an Isaiah Thomas, if Avery Bradley is hitting perimeter shots, or a Marcus Smart, or even a Jaylen Brown to a lesser degree, that can cause Cleveland some problems. But in the end, unlike Washington, they have LeBron James. And because that's the neutralizer, the ultimate neutralizer, I really don't see Boston winning more than one game in this series.
I've seen them play before. You know, we played them four times. I think they're better than any of the four times we played them, including the last one where they smashed us. So we're going to have to play really well. The most important thing the coaches can do is make it as simple as possible in a short term, which is easier said than done against these guys.
I thought about it a lot. I mean, all night last night and day, I watched 2008 Paul Pierce versus LeBron and how special that game was. Two superstars going at it, guarding each other. It was a historic game. So I definitely did my studying, and I knew it was going to be a big-time game tonight. I knew it wasn't going to be easy at all. We came out on top, so that says a lot about the team we are, and we believe in each other. So we kept going to stay the course, and that was what this team has done all season long. So it's a special moment for us, but we only have a little time to celebrate, and then we got to focus on the Cavs.
You don't see this happen too often, so you know there's something going on. And a look of concern on the faces of Mickey Callaway and Terry Francona. Well, you have to wonder now, looking back when Mickey Callaway went out, when he came back to talk to Terry Francona, if there wasn't something of a physical nature that they were discussing. That's the last thing.
Well, I'm sure Tito will look him in the eyes and ask him himself.
Like, the left pec area was tight. I don't think anybody thinks it's anything more than that, but, you know, he wasn't letting it go. You know, made me start to worry a little bit. So when I'm out there, finally kind of said, yeah, it's tight. So we got him out, but it's hopeful that maybe a couple of days just kind of remedy that. We'll see.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Thanks for being with us. We are Toledo's sports leader. Got a great program lined up for you today. A lot of really, really interesting things to talk about. Finally, after what seems like 3.5 months, there is an opponent for the Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Finals. It is the Boston Celtics, who were able to take advantage of the ultimate choke job put out last night by John Wall of the Washington Wizards, who missed his final 11 shots in a close 1-2 possession game. Then when it was 110-100, pressed even more, finished 2-for-13 in the second half, and will watch the best point guard in the Eastern Conference. No, not Isaiah Thomas, but Kyrie Irving in the Eastern Conference Finals. Rather than playing against him, he will watch him. And that is where we start this afternoon right here on The Ticket. Jim Cushlin is with us. Hey, say hello, Mr. Cushlin.
What's going on?
Mr. Frank Argano is with us as well. What's going on, Frankie?
Nothing too much, Bob. Just enjoying the beautiful day.
Boys, we spent some time late last week talking about the choke job by James Harden, and people trying to figure out, was he sick? Was he drugged? Was he injured? Did he just choke? Did he quit? Nobody could figure out what he did. But you know what? He wasn't alone. If you look at the tank jobs done by some of the great scoring point guards in the postseason this year, it seems to be something of an epidemic. Russell Westbrook put up all of those tremendous triple-double numbers all season long, put up some big numbers in the postseason as well. But you saw in all of the games that he lost to Harden and the Rockets, his fourth quarters were awful, straight up atrocious. Ball gets a little bit more slick when the money's on the line in the fourth quarter, doesn't it? Heart starts to beat just a little bit faster. You grip it just a little bit tighter. You dribble it just a little bit harder. And you release it just a little bit more quickly because I got to get it off before the defense closes out. And you saw Harden tank. You saw Westbrook tank. And now, last night, for two out of the last three games, you saw John Wall tank in the fourth quarter. We keep hearing about all of these great point guards in the National Basketball Association. One of them is going to be the MVP, probably Westbrook. Obviously, Curry has won back-to-back MVPs and became last season the only player in the history of the sport to be a unanimous MVP. But more and more, I look at all of these guys, Damian Lillard out there in Portland, you could say too, Chris Paul, as much as I love him, he's a different kind of cat because he's not the ball dominant score first guy. He's a true point guard who can also score. But for the rest of them, you know, we hear about all of these great point guards. And I'm going to tell you what, watching John Wall choke away his chance to seize the moment, to elevate himself into that pantheon, because, you know, he's been very vocal. He's been very loud in this point guard comparison discussion about how he doesn't get enough respect. How come he's not a perennial all-star? How come his name isn't thrown in there with Westbrook and Curry and Irving and Lillard and Paul and who am I missing? Isaiah now that he had this breakout year, the Isaiah Jr., if you will, in Boston. Who am I missing? Anybody else on that list?
That's a pretty comprehensive list. I'd settle with that list.
And strangely enough, guys, you know whose name is not on that list? The guy who makes more money than anybody else in the National Basketball Association, Mike Conley. Mike Conley Jr. is the highest paid player in the NBA this
year. That's right, yeah.
And he did not make my list of six or seven guys. But anyway, John Wall, as you know, has been very vocal about that. He's ticked off. He doesn't think he's getting his due. Last night was his opportunity to punch his ticket into that conversation. Last night was his opportunity to elevate himself into the conference finals, a series away from going to the finals, and really showing the world what he is. Five games, six games, seven games potentially against Kyrie one-on-one. Really show the world. And this dude, like so many others, choked. And I'm going to tell you something. I say this not to bury John Wall, even though it's doing that. I say this to elevate and remind everybody of the greatness of a guy, you know, and I might tick off some Pistons fans if I steal Chauncey's nickname here, but a guy who has proven to be a fourth quarter clutch shooter, the guy that you want the ball to be in his hands with a game on the line, even though he plays with LeBron James, the guy that you want to take that shot in that moment to make that run at that moment. Kyrie Irving has become Mr. Big Shot. And if you want to call him Mr. Big Shot 2.0, you can. And again, if you're a Pistons fan who loves Chauncey, you don't like anybody stealing his name, find me a comparable name to Mr. Big Shot and I'll consider it. But Kyrie Irving is a fourth quarter star. You remember what happened in game four in the sweep of the Raptors? When the Raptors had narrowed that lead down to single digits, in fact, it was a one or two possession game, who won on a personal 11-0 run against the Raptors to close them out? It was indeed Kyrie Irving. He doesn't shrink from the biggest moments. And obviously, when we look back at Game 7 of the NBA Finals a year ago between the Cavaliers and the Warriors on the road in Oaktown, by the Bay, the 73-win Warriors, on the verge of closing out a series they once led 3-1, but they're not going to let get away from them in Game 7, not at home. You remember the three-pronged clincher? You remember the block, the shot, and the stop, right? You remember the block, the shot, and the stop. The block was LeBron James on Andre Iguodala. The stop was Kevin Love on Steph Curry. The shot, the winner, the dagger, what belonged to Kyrie Irving. So last night, John Wall, for me, proving that he is nowhere near ready for that prime time. For me, John Wall's failure last night really answered the question, as far as I'm concerned, who is the best point guard in the East? And I'll tell you something else. As far as I'm concerned, who is one of the top 3 point guards in the National Basketball Association? His name is Kyrie Irving. And Kyrie Irving will battle Isaiah Thomas and the Celtics in game number one tomorrow on the road in Boston. We heard something in the montage about that. I'll play later once again and talk about whether or not you believe it as we continue this afternoon right here on the Extravaganza. All right. Now, you also heard in the montage at the top of the show a little bit of baseball conversation. The Tigers are back from their West Coast trip. They are in Detroit tonight at Comerica. They're going to be hosting the Baltimore Orioles. And just to get a little bit of a fix and an update on the Tigers, who come into tonight's game at 18-18, exactly at 500, Matt Mowry joins us for a little chat. He is on the Tigers beat for the Oakland Press. Matt, welcome back to the program here in Toledo. It's good to have you. How are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
We're good, man. We're good. We got a lot of things going on. I know you obviously are on the Tigers beat, but you into the NBA playoffs? How you digging things?
I watch a little bit, but with the schedule, I've got to watch games and, you know, pay attention to baseball as much as I can. So I don't see as much basketball as I really used to. But yeah, I'll catch a game here or there.
Yeah, I feel you. It's especially, you know, like you said, when you're on the beat, it's a different thing than if you're just, you know, a columnist or something like that. And you have a little more free time. You're on the beat. You got a lot of work to do. And you do it for the Oakland Press. And I know you got to cover the pregame presser with Brad. So we'll get right down to business. Give us your overall general state of the Tigers now. I mentioned the 18-18. They come back off of the road trip from the West. It's good to be back home again. Where are they right now in your eyes?
Well, I think they can't be unhappy with a road trip like they had simply because Anaheim has always been such a house of horrors for them, and they came out of there relatively unscathed. In fact, they had a shot there in the last game to win their first four-game series in Anaheim since 94, I believe. So just the fact that they did okay and they kind of treaded water, it seems like that's kind of been the story of the first portion of the season for the Tigers, kind of treading water while Miguel Cabrera was out, treading water while J.D. Martinez was out, you know, kind of treading water until they figured things out in the bullpen. And now it seems like they've got kind of some of those gears lined up the way they need them lined up. Everybody's relatively healthy. They've got their bullpen aligned, I think, in a way that's a little more palatable to most people who are watching. And I think right now is a time where they could kind of downshift, so to speak, and kind of go on a little run if they're going to make one. But I don't think it being 18-18 right now is any shock to anyone, because I think that's kind of what everybody thought this team was. They're a team that has a lot of talented pieces, but they also have a lot of depth issues, and they have some, you know, relatively glaring question marks coming into the season as far as, you know, how healthy everybody was going to be and how things were going to pan out, specifically like the bullpen. So I think right now being 18-18 is perfectly satisfactory.
You know, that's a really interesting analysis, and it's funny when you mentioned the bullpen. It certainly has been a problem, as it was kind of, I don't say expected to be, but feared that it would be. But the lineup is still chock full of really, really talented, productive major league hitters that are not being, they're talented, but they're not being very productive right now. Ian Kinsler right. Sitting 223. I mean, Miguel Cabrera, for crying out loud, the legend that he is, the Hall of Famer in waiting that he is hitting 238. He hasn't homered in 10 games. And I think I read earlier today that Victor's 270 is the highest batting average among the regulars, which is crazy, you know, that nobody's over 270. And he's not hitting with any power either. So to what do you attribute the can we still call it a slow start now in the middle of May, about 6 weeks in? Do we still call this a slow start for the lineup?
Well, I think it depends on who you're looking at. I mean, both Ian and Miggy have had some health issues, obviously, so that can disrupt your timing. And certainly before, you know, either of them got hurt and neither was going very strongly, it is a little bit concerning. But I think when as you said, you run down that list, and that's a list of guys that have very, very extensive track records of success. So, yeah, are you worried a little bit that they're not living up to that? Sure, absolutely. I mean, it's obviously not what they're hoping for. It's obviously not what this team is built to do. But I think the fact that they do have those extensive track records, I mean, if we were sitting here thinking, oh my gosh, we're, you know, Tyler Collins is underproducing and, you know, so is Steven Moya and so is, you know, those guys, obviously, you don't know what you're going to get out of them. But I think it's relatively safe to assume that, you know, sure, maybe one of those three guys between Victor, Miggy, and Kinsler is going to have an off year and not have a great year. But I don't think it's logical to expect that all three of them will. And frankly, if all three of them have very, very bad years, I think you're looking at a 500 team. I think that's probably the most you could hope for if a large portion of your first four batters of the lineup have off years, you're probably not going to be a very good offense. So
I might even look at it more pessimistically than you. If all four of those guys have that bad of a year with the numbers that we're talking about now through 6 weeks, if they last 6 months, I think they'd be lucky to be 500.
They'll probably be
way below 500 if that continues. You know, for the entirety of the season. We're talking to Matt Mowry, who is a beat writer covering the Tigers for the Oakland Press, and Jim Cushlin is with us as well, Matt, and he's got a question for you. Jimmy, go ahead.
And there is one thing that's going to help the Tigers lineup, though, is over the weekend in that series to finish off against the Angels, they finally got J.D. Martinez back, took 9 at-bats in the final three games, couple of homers in the Saturday win. Obviously, how has he looked from your vantage point? What does he look like three games in? He's clearly healthy enough, has a couple homers, as I mentioned, and how important is it that he's finally back in the lineup? Because these are his first at-bats all season.
Yeah, and I think, as you probably recall, it was even a couple days earlier than they thought they were going to bring him back, and it just happened, you know, with Odusi getting hurt. They brought him back a couple of days early. I think they were aiming at today for bringing JD back, but he's going to be a little bit rusty. He's faced, you know, extended spring training and AAA pitchers for the most part up until now, so, you know, he hasn't faced major league pitching until this weekend, so it's going to probably take him a little while to shake off the rust too. But yeah, getting him back in the lineup, getting him healthy, getting him right, getting him squared away, and getting that lineup lengthened out is really, really, I mean, that's key for the next 2 or 3 months because, yeah, like we said, the fate of this team is going to depend on how well and how long they can stick in this race. And, you know, JD is going to be one of those guys who theoretically, you know, come July, if the Tigers are no longer in it, would be a prime trade candidate for somebody to, you know, a contender to come pick up a bat like that and stick in their lineup. So it's going to be key for him to get hot and get hot relatively fast for the Tigers to kind of, you know, forestall the fact that they may have to trade him.
We're talking to Matt Mowry of the Oakland Press, covers the Detroit Tigers. They are back home tonight against the Baltimore Orioles. How you looking, or how you feeling right now as you look, Matt, at the Central Division? Obviously, it's still very, very early, but it's a very, very tightly packed division. The Twins surprisingly on top right now. Indians, Tigers, White Sox all within a game, two and a half games of one another. Even the Royals are only 4.5 back, and I guess that's just a, you know, testament to the time because we're only 6 weeks in. But nobody's running away with the division is my point in all of that. So while they're hitting 220 and 230 and all of the stuff we're talking about, while JD was out, while the bullpen has imploded and they've had to get rid of K-Rod and try something else, all of that, they're still right there right now. Do you think this division is going to stay tightly packed very long?
I think it will stay tightly packed for the reason that I think the Tigers and the Indians are definitely, you know, especially when we looked at it at the beginning of the season, those are two other teams that we figured would be the class of the division. The White Sox were kind of a wild card, and we weren't sure if the Royals were going to kind of continue their run over the last couple of years, and the way they started out, it didn't look like it. I think the surprising one is the Twins, and just based on, you know, looking at what the Twins have in their pitching, it does not give me a whole lot of hope that they stick in it for the long term. I mean, I'm certainly sure that they're glad that they're playing as well as they are and pitching as well as they are at this point in the season, but I'm not sure they have the, you know, the stamina to do that throughout the season. So I wouldn't be surprised if they begin to slide back toward the pack and then, you know, maybe end up on the bottom side of the pack in the next month or so, and it kind of clarifies into more of a 2 or 3 team race. But I don't think it's surprising to anyone that there are quite a few teams within, you know, 2 or 3 games of the lead. Cleveland was clearly the favorite coming into the season, but I don't know that they were the, you know, I'm not sure people expected them to win this division by, you know, 17 games or anything like that. I think I think everybody kind of thought that they'd win it, but they'd win it by, you know, maybe five or six.
Yeah, some of the other teams, though, you know, that were expected to win their divisions are jumping out, and like in the West, for example, the Astros have an 8-game lead already over their next closest competitor. In fact, two, the Angels and Rangers are both 8 games behind, and the Mariners 9. You know, the Nats have an 8-game lead. Now, I'm not saying it should be 8 for the Indians either, but the fact that nobody has pulled out by 4 or 5 even at this particular point in time, I don't know, because, you know, the Indians that would be and should be favorites, the defending champions in the division and in the American League, are facing some of the similar things you and I just discussed about the Tigers with their lineup. They're not getting any production at all from Edwin Encarnacion, 198, worse than Miguel as far as where that is right now, just 5 home runs. They finally knocked him out of the cleanup spot. Brantley still in and out of the lineup, injured. Kipnis just came back and is starting to swing the bat. The point being that a lot of their big guns aren't firing yet either. So I just kind of wonder, is this just all, you know, 4, 5, 6 week, warm-up period doldrums and they're really going to extend themselves out, or if this is just something that's going to be, nip and tuck for a while?
Well, I think like we said about the Tigers, too, it may come down between those two teams to which of the two can get those guys going more quickly and which can start to make a little bit of a separation. If the Tigers, you know, get Victor and Miggy going in the next couple of weeks and then JD comes along and they start to put a little bit of a separation, you know, between them and the Indians, that's certainly bodes well, you know, and that certainly could mean that they're in it for the long haul. I think with the Indians, they're looking at the same thing. I think they're probably, you know, not satisfied with where they're at. But they're also looking at the fact that, you know, with all of these problems that we've had, if we get this guy going, if we get, you know, Encarnacion going a little bit, if we get Kipnis healthy, if we get Brantley back, you know, all of those kind of things, if they can do that in the next, you know, 2 or 3 weeks and start to put some separation. I think the difference between the two is if the Indians start to put some separation between themselves and the Tigers truly feel that they're not in it, they may be in a position to sell. And I'm not sure the opposite is true. I'm not sure if the Indians start to slide out of the race if they become a seller. I mean, they may sell off a part or here or there, but I'm not sure they kind of go into it with the gusto that the Tigers might. So I think that might be the difference between the two, but I think they're kind of looking at the same scenario for what they're trying to accomplish before that.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, too. Good analysis. Matt Mowry joining us again. Matt covers the Tigers on the beat for the Oakland Press. Matt, really appreciate the time. I know you got to go cover Mr. Ausmus before the game tonight. Wade Miley for the O's and Matt Boyd for the Tigers. So we'll let you get running. We appreciate your time this afternoon, and we'll talk to you again down the line.
Sounds good. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks very much, Matt. There you go. Matt Mowry from the Oakland Press talking a little bit of Tigers baseball with us. It's 3:30. We've got we got SportsCenter coming your way here in a moment, but you know what else we've got for you? We've got our ticket sweet deal of the week. That's what we've got. And it's a 4-pack of tickets to Splash Universe in Dundee. Doesn't it sound great to get wet right about now? You get up into the high 80s on a day like this in May. You want to go and splash and have fun? Log on to 1065theticket.com tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. and get your family 4-pack of tickets to Splash Universe. It's worth $130. You get it for 35. What? Yeah, 35 while supplies last at 1065theticket.com. Or you get them for $0 right now. 4-pack for you, free. If you are the 8th caller at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065, we'll set you up with a family 4-pack of tickets to Splash Universe in Dundee. And we're back after the Sports Center, which is coming up right here on ESPN 1065, The Ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
All right, 3:39, we roll onward. Bob France with you on the extravaganza. Jim Cushlin and Frank Gargana are at my side as almost always, and good conversation. You know, guys, speaking of baseball, since we're on it, just real quick, Cushlin, you being an Indians guy like me, kind of transitioning from the Tigers conversation, Carrasco, who has been just flat out lights out all season, leaving yesterday, and you had it in the montage, obviously. He left after the fourth inning, I believe. His fastball, I read one of their beat writers on Twitter last night monitoring it, started out at 95, 96 in the first, and by the fourth it was down to 92.5. It was clear something was wrong. He wasn't able to cut it loose, as you heard Terry Francona say. Well, I'll tell you what, with Kluber already on the DL and with Bauer being inconsistent and with Tomlin, kind of, well, I don't want to say he's been more consistent of late, but you get the point.
Yeah.
Salazar, but they can't afford to lose their most reliable starter for very long.
No, they absolutely can't. And then that's why so far it sounds like good news. You heard Francona from yesterday. There's been no update on that since then. So right now they're thinking he might miss a start, but not a disabled list trip necessarily. Although, of course, you can do that nowadays since it's been reduced to 10 instead of 15. So, but as of right now, they don't seem to have any plans for that. But you're absolutely right. They can't afford to lose him at this moment, even with them just a half game out, because you're right, of what's going on with the rest of the rotation. Side note on all that, because of a couple of these injury notes, I find it interesting that in place of Almonte, and they just lost Brandon Guyer for 4 to 6 weeks, actually, Sunday, I believe. Yeah, Sunday he left the game and then got put on the DL then, so it's been 48 hours. They lost two of their backup outfielders. I find it interesting that it's Bradley Zimmer that they call up.
Yeah, it is very interesting. He's been the number one, you know, his former number one pick, obviously, and one of, if not the very top outfield prospects. Do you think it's too soon?
Well, I'm not so sure. And by the way,
obviously they don't. They think he's ready. They wanted to, and they've had a pretty good feel for that, I think, in recent years. You know, some people felt like they were rushing Lindor, even though his glove was going to be major league ready.
Yeah.
His bat was not, we were told. And geez, all he is now is one of the most productive hitters in the American League.
I didn't play the highlight of his eighth inning home run yesterday because after, you know, Carrasco losing his fastball, Indians, you know, looked good after about an inning and a half, and then Carrasco's thing happened. Suddenly, that was a one run game in the eighth inning, and he gave him the insurance, did Lindor, late in this. The other side note when it comes to Zimmer being called up is I wonder if this partly has something to do with it. Remember, they opened the season with Tyler Naquin, of course, in center, didn't play as well and had his own issues with his back. He is back from that. He is still on the DL in Columbus with the back injury. So that's another reason I think it was Zimmer because, you know, quite frankly, Tyler Naquin's not even ready, even if they wanted to.
It's pretty amazing how quickly you can forget about somebody. Tyler Naquin was, for a while last year, neck and neck with Fulmer for Rookie of the Year in the American League, it was perceived. You know, he caught the fascination of everybody with that tremendous sprint around the bases and that head first slide and then the rising up and the
That's one of the visual like
cowabunga sign or whatever. Yeah. You know, the fist pump with the
from an Indian's point of view, that's one of the wonderful visuals from all of last season.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That it's just kind of I don't know if you want to say it personified or exemplified who they were or whatever, because you know it's not like he was their best player, but
right.
But you know he was sent down and he got hurt down there and you kind of forgot about him when they brought up Zimmer. I didn't even think to myself, Jim, I didn't think, why Zimmer, why not Naquin? Oh, and if I'm to find out he's still hurt, I just kind of forgot about Naquin even being down there.
Right.
It's amazing how fast that happens.
And that's what I'm saying. I don't think that's the sole reason for having it Zimmer getting called up in place of Almonte and now Guyer, who are on the deal. I just think that's the clinching reason that, well, even if we wanted to go to Naquin, he's still healing up that back.
Yeah, exactly. So that's just a kind of crazy thing. Last thing on them, real quick, because I want to get back to basketball.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of finally Terry Francona saying, okay, you know, I rode it as long as I can ride it, and I hoped for as long as I could hope that, you know, his struggles would end and he would go back to being the all-star masher that he is. So I finally got to knock Edwin out of the cleanup spot. And it was only one spot down to the five. He didn't want to embarrass him or humiliate him by batting him seventh or eighth. But clearly, you know, whatever was, you know, bothering him in spring training, and was bothering him in early April is still bothering him. When I say bothering, by the way, I'm not suggesting he's injured, like he's a nagging injury bothering him. I mean,
sure.
But whatever is causing him to not be the consistent, productive hitter that he has been for the last 6, 7, 8 years, one of the very best over the last five, averaging between 39 and 45 home runs a season, whatever it is, it still isn't there. It's gone.
Yeah.
And now he's batting fifth. I just wonder what it's going to take. And you know what else I was really wondering, too, and either one of you guys can weigh in on this. Frank joined the conversation, but guys, I wonder how much we can attribute Encarnacion's production in Toronto to the presence of Joey Bats and the number of pitches he got to see because of Bautista. I just wonder if there wasn't something to that. And that's not to say there are no other good hitters in the Indians lineup to protect him. but there's nobody that's a 45 to 50 home run guy himself like Joey Bats working in concert with Edwin Encarnacion.
That's an interesting thought. I will reserve my personal judgment on that one. I feel I need to see more. It's still only May 16th at this point, so maybe it's just, you know, more of an early slump rather than that. But, you know, if some of these things keep playing out numbers-wise for Encarnacion like that, then sure, that becomes much more of a distinct possibility. And as to your original question on that, I'm fine with Terry Francona having done this with the lineup, because remember, in a way, it's not just the Encarnacion.
It might even be late. You know, I mean, he maybe possibly should have done this 2 weeks ago.
Sure, but it's not just the Encarnacion switch. It's the swapping Santana and Kipnis in the leadoff spot thing too.
Yeah, well, he's juggled the lineup a couple of times now in the last three games, and that's needed. And I like the idea. And obviously, Kipnis responded, for crying out loud. Yep. That's tremendous.
Because we were talking about numbers. We were mentioning some of the batting average from the Tigers. Do you know who the highest batting average amongst an Indian right now is?
No.
Brantley at 287.
And he's not really, he hasn't been
and
in
we
there
still
a ton
feel
because
like,
of,
yeah, we still feel like he's not quite 100%, right?
Well, he's not, but it's not because of the shoulder. It's because of the right. You know, the ankle or
yes.
the foot or whatever.
But he has the highest batting average right now amongst Indians regulars at 287.
Yeah, and but at least they are getting a little bit of production, you know, some power production spread out throughout the lineup. They don't have a guy with 10 home runs, but they do have some, they have some guys who have been spread around a little bit, which is...
I'm at least encouraged by their last 2 days. Obviously, it's baseball being baseball, but the last 2 days, they put up a bunch of runs, and even Francona said after Sunday's game...
Chisholm's getting hot. Chisholm's getting really hot, which is huge for them.
Francona said after...
obviously coming into form. If Encarnacion can just get out of his own way and figure out what it is and accidentally run into a couple and get himself on a positive momentum where he tries to finally remember, hey, I don't have to be in Toronto. I don't have to be in that building to do this on a regular basis.
Perfect example. Last night in the eighth, after Lindor's home run that gave the Indians back a 2-run lead, and then Cody Allen gave up a home run to make it back to a 1-run game, they put a couple guys on, and then Encarnacion's up with two outs, and he just taps one, rolls it over to short. I'm not asking for a 3-run homer there.
Right.
You know, but, you know, that kind of at bat kind of, to me, encapsulated his season thus far. Yeah, he may have 5 home runs, but it's the .98 as of right now that's bugging
a
lot of people.
I read a Twitter fan's account of this last night, and I did not watch last night's game. I just had to see the highlights and read the box score. But I read one Twitter fan's account of it. At one point, Encarnacion hit a ground ball and beat out the double play relay, and a run scored. And essentially, so it's a fielder's choice.
Yeah.
And according to the Twitter fan, the TV announcers, Underwood and Manning, were just heaping praise all over him for that incredible hustle down the line. And while that's fine, great, let's acknowledge the hustle, The Twitter fan basically was saying, it's come to this. Edwin Encarnacion, who signed a contract worth how much money? What did they give him? Do you remember the numbers?
It was one,
I just had
once 40s, once something. I can't remember the exact number.
That's all right.
$60 million.
How much? $60 million?
$60 million contract over 3 years.
For 3 years. So $20 million a year. So Edwin Encarnacion, who averages 42 home runs a year and 110 RBIs over the last 5 years, is now being cheered for beating out a fielder's choice. That, to me, said a lot.
Yeah.
That Twitter user really kind of encapsulated it. That's how far he has fallen, at least in this early going in his career. And now others were...
Sad, but good point.
It is a very good point. I mean, if you're grasping at straws looking for positive things to say about a guy who's supposed to hit, you know, 250, 260 with 40 home runs, if you're grasping at straws and you got to come up with he hustled down the line on a fielder's choice, you're in trouble. No doubt about that. But there were others on Twitter, and I'm not endorsing this and I'm not condoning this. You don't want to try to chase a guy out of town.
Mm-hmm.
But others are saying, I feel like, and I'm paraphrasing Twitter last night as far as the Indians fans go, I feel like he is saying, I don't like it here. I don't want to be here. I'd rather be in Toronto. Some are saying, is his play indicative of his comfort level playing in Cleveland, that he doesn't like it out there? And you know, because there's no way a guy of his talent and his consistent production can be doing this unless he's seriously emotionally bothered by where he is. And again, I'm not endorsing that viewpoint. But I'll entertain the argument. I'll entertain the question. You know, how is he physically not able to do what he has always been able to do? If it isn't physical, is it mental? Is it emotional? Is it I really miss where I was? Is it I miss being back-to-back in the lineup with Joey Batts? What is it? Nobody knows. 42 home runs, 127 RBIs last year, for crying out loud. You know, a guy who has just been about as productive of a power hitter as anybody in baseball for the last 5 years average, suddenly can't hit, you know, his weight. He's batting 198, now maybe 206 is what I think I saw the most. You know, and he's in an 0 for 12 slump right now. He's batting 0.94, 3 for 32 with 6 RBIs with runners in scoring position. You know, it makes you wonder, does this guy want to be here? And some Indians fans were already saying, you know what, if you don't like it here, go someplace else. And
boy, I'll tell you this.
That's not possible. He's got a $60 yeah. million dollar contract, and so he's here for better or worse matter what, and he's going to be in the lineup for better or worse no matter
what. I'll say this. I'm not flat out calling it wrong like you. I'll entertain the idea, but I'll say this, Bob. I'd rather have it be something physical than that.
I would too.
Honest to goodness.
If it's an injury, put him on the 10-day DL. Hell, put him on the 60-day DL for that matter. I don't care, however long it has to be to get him right. And then when he comes back, we know physically it's back. You're right. But if it is emotional or mental or comfort level or whatever it is, then God, you know, I mean, I don't know how you fix that. I mean, you got to hire a team psychiatrist to come in and talk to the guy. I don't know.
Remember, the Blue Jays are struggling too. They're in the basement right now, the AL East. Have been basically since day one.
Kind of a crazy thing. Hey, one more thought, because it's 3:52, and well, do I want to go? I wanted to talk basketball next, but I want to spend more time on it, so maybe that'll be the next hour. I wonder if I should do this quick story about the Browns, real quick. Jabril Peppers, you know, the Michigan stud, the all everything, do everything, you know, Swiss Army knife that he was. The surprise, according to some, 25th overall pick in the first round draft by the Browns, right? Jabril, of course, we know tested with the diluted sample at the combine and now is going to enter his NFL career in stage one of the NFL's drug policy program. I don't know if you guys have heard about this or not, but one of the Browns radio stations, you know, one of their flagship broadcast stations,
Actually,
there's actually two different companies that share their rights, a talk show on a Cleveland station featured a girl, one of the female talk show hosts or sidekicks or whatever you want to call it on one of the stations there, went on a rant last week about Jabril Peppers, saying he is going to be damaged goods. He'll never make it because he's a huge drug addict, saying that he is constantly on the Molly.
Oh, I saw this.
Did you see this?
Yeah, now that you bring it up, I think I saw this.
Molly is what? That's code for I don't know all my drugs very well, I'm sorry to say. Well, I'm not really sorry to say. Molly is code for, what's the one that starts with E?
Ecstasy.
Is it ecstasy? Maybe
I think
it's
ecstasy and, like, cocaine.
Ecstasy, okay. Well, she claimed that he was on the Molly and the something else, another one of those code words for a certain kind of drug, right?
Okay.
And we all know that he tested diluted samples, so this
right.
is... But she's
it's
claiming...
not outside of the realm of possibility.
She's not... Right. But she wasn't claiming the, I'll bet you that's what it was thing. She was claiming the, no, I know for a fact he does this stuff. And he's never going to make it. He's going to be another Josh Gordon. Well, because she made these statements so directly and not, this is what I suspect, mm-hmm. which you're allowed to say.
Sure.
She said, this is true. This is what I know. She's accusing a public figure of being a drug addict without any evidence to support it whatsoever. She got fired from her job. I bring all of that up as the backdrop for Jabril Peppers, who's at the Browns rookie minicamp now, and of course he was asked about this situation. Somebody on you know, Browns media in Cleveland said, you are a major drug addict. So this is what the former Michigan Wolverine star had to say in response.
Whatever drug she said I've done, I've never done in my life. So this is my first time in Cleveland since, you know, they flew me out here. You know, so I don't know what she's talking about. You know, I just think, you know, people just say what they want to say to make stories. I don't really buy into that. You know, I came here to play football, help this great organization, you know, get back to prominence, and, you know, that's what I'm going to do. Like I said before, you know, I never failed a drug test in my life, never been arrested. So people want to speculate on that for other reasons, which, you know, we all know what those reasons are. Then so be it. I'm just here to be the best person and football player I can be. Learn from the vets, learn from the great coaches, the new coaching staff, and you know, that's what I intend to do. And no one's going to take this moment away from me. You know, I don't care, you know, what it is. I worked my whole life to get here, and you know, I'm happy to be here. You know, I'm not going to let know what people say about me ruin the best moment of my life. You kidding me? You know, I've been talked about, hated on my whole life, so there's no skin off my teeth. So to answer your question, no, I'm extremely happy. You know, I'm happy to prove myself again, happy to, you know, learn from the vets. You know, I get to play with guys like Joe Hayden, Jamie Collins, you know, Kirksey, you know, so we have, you know, a lot of things that, you know, we want to do as a unit, but it all starts now. Got to keep building those building blocks in.
Is it?
You know, hopefully we get to where we need to be.
All right, so that's Jabril Peppers talking to Cleveland media about the talk show host that declared he is a major drug addict, and he's going to wash out just like Josh Gordon. As we know, Josh Gordon just failed in his attempt to be reinstated because he is under a permanent ban right now, or banned indefinitely until the commissioner decides to let him in. So what do you guys think of the response there? And by the way, just to clarify again, I also have questioned only because of the diluted sample. My question was, you know, which one is it? Is it because I completely can see a guy with his history of cramping, as everybody has well known, the water argument that he chugged a bunch of water, multiple bottles over multiple hours before his workout, because it's how you prevent cramping when you are, you know, a very tightly muscled athlete like him who gets cramped before the combine and before he worked out for two different positions at that combine. I can totally see his argument. However, if it isn't that, then we have to assume that he did drink so much water simply to cover up something in his system, which would lead one to believe, to suspect anyway, that he has a problem if you couldn't stay off of whatever it is you liked for 30 days before the combine when you know a test is coming. That's what the whole country speculated on with respect to Jabril Peppers from Michigan. But this woman just said, no, he's a drug addict straight up, and he's going to wash out. What did you think of his response? Personally, I was impressed by the way he handled
it. Yeah, I was impressed by the way he handled it. He's got to toe that line in his response to make sure that gets his point across, which is, no, I've never done this, or you know, and that's what he's trying to say. So yeah, I thought it was, from his point of view, it was as decent a response as you can have.
What do you think, Frank?
Yeah, I thought it was very casual. Like Kush said, he got his point across, but he wasn't, like, extremely defensive of it. It was more of like, come on, guys, I'm just here to play football. I've only been to Cleveland once before this. You know, he's here to do business, and until we see any hard evidence, I'm sorry, I just have to dismiss it.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, that's why I was impressed with how he handled it, because you do have a line to toe there. If you come out there screaming, what did that bee say about me? But if you come out really outraged, you've heard the old phrase, methinks thou dost protest too much.
Yeah.
If you are going that crazy, you're very sensitive about this issue, and you may have something to hide. If you blow it off altogether and say, man, I don't want to talk about that, then it looks like maybe you are acknowledging there is something going on there. I thought he was very matter of fact. Look, I've never used any drugs. I've never tested positive on a drug test, which he can't really technically say now because of the NFL rule that says we see a diluted sample as a positive test.
Right, which
is why
over.
You're in this program now.
Yep.
So technically he can't say that, but technically he can. If he wants to say, look, I've never taken a drug test and had it come back, you have this in your system. You've had marijuana or whatever. So
that's why it is technically called diluted sample, right, not a positive sample.
Because it can't be, right, because it can't be tested. It's
exactly.
Too diluted by water. So, you know, I really thought he did a good job, and I've said this before, and I'm going to say this again. I don't care who drafted Jabril Peppers. I told you this during the combine. I told you this during the run-up to the draft. I'm rooting for this kid like I'm rooting for a few others. I just am, because of his unselfishness while at Michigan, knowing that he has one position that he could play and excel at and be first-team All-American at, but knowing that his team and his coach needs him to do more things, so he's going to split time between that position that he excels at and another position where he's really, really good, but maybe it's not his best, most natural position, like linebacker. And oh, by the way, we need you to return kicks. And oh, by the way, we need you to play some offense, too, and run the ball and catch the ball. That unselfishness can make him look like the proverbial jack-of-all-trades, master of none. He can do everything a little bit well, but nothing exceptionally well.
Right.
And because he was willing to do that, I feel like he was almost punished by some analysts leading into the draft. And even now, after the Browns took him, some said, oh, that's a D. They're giving the Browns a D for that pick in the first round. What did Peppers do so well to help them? This is a reach. And I'm saying this not because I'm from Cleveland and I'm a Browns guy. If he went to the Lions, if he went to the Cowboys, if he went to the Bears, if he went to the Seahawks, I wouldn't care. I'd be a Jabril Peppers fan and cheering for this kid. And guess what? He just happens to be wearing an orange helmet, so I'm really, really rooting for the kid, and I hope everything that he said in that response there that I just played for you is right. Hey, congratulations to Damon Drews of Wauseon. He won the sweet deal of the week, which means he's going to go to Splash Universe in Dundee. If you did not win, which would be everybody not named Damon Drews, you can get your $130 four-pack of tickets to Splash Universe tomorrow morning at 1065theticket.com for just $35. That's our sweet deal of the week. Hour number two coming up. If you're on hold, stay there. If you're not on hold, get there, because we're talking NBA next on The Ticket.
LeBron's had his best performances on the road throughout the course of his career, and he said he prefers playing on the road. As much as he loves the Cleveland fans, as much as he loves the home court advantage, that adversity gets the most out of him. And Teron Lue said he prefers actually to start a series on the road as well, because it's a feel-out game, and the home team has the pressure to protect that home court. And if you can steal that one, you change the entire series.
We put in a lot of work, you know, these last few days, and it's exciting for us to get back on the court. We're playing against a worthy opponent. Great coaching staff, great players, and we look forward to the challenge. You know, the Celtics is our next opponent, and like I said, they're a worthy opponent. We have the game plan, what they bring to the table. We have to mentally focus on our challenges that we have every game. You know, we've been off, it'll be 10 days tomorrow, you know, since we played a game. The rhythm is something that you kind of like, you know, see if we still have it. But as far as the mental side, we're focused.
If you're Isaiah Thomas, you could do some damage in a series like this, because Kyrie Irving is going to kill you with his offense. Even though he can play defense, he's not a stout defender. And as a result, you're going to find pick-and-roll situations where the Channing Frye's and Kevin Love's of the world are going to find themselves defending some of these guards. With an Isaiah Thomas, if Avery Bradley is hitting perimeter shots, or a Marcus Smart, or even a Jaylen Brown to a lesser degree, that can cause Cleveland some problems. But in the end, unlike Washington, they have LeBron James. And because that's the neutralizer, the ultimate neutralizer, I really don't see Boston winning more than one game in this series.
I've seen them play before. You know, we played them four times. I think they're better than any of the four times we played them, including the last one where they smashed us. So we're going to have to play really well. The most important thing the coaches can do is make it as simple as possible in a short term, which is easier said than done against these guys.
I thought about it a lot. I mean, all night last night and day, I watched 2008 Paul Pierce versus LeBron and how special that game was. Two superstars going at it, guarding each other. It was a historic game. So I definitely did my studying, and I knew it was going to be a big-time game tonight. I knew it wasn't going to be easy at all. We came out on top, so that says a lot about the team we are, and we believe in each other, so we kept going to stay the course, and that was what this team has done all season long. So it's a special moment for us, but we only have a little time to celebrate, and then got to focus on the Cavs.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. They finally have an opponent for the Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Finals. As we continue into hour number two now, it's 11 minutes after 4, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Jim Cushlin has checked out for the afternoon. Frank Gargano is still with us. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. But I want to play the first part of that montage again with respect to where the series will start tomorrow night, which is in Boston.
LeBron's had his best performances on the road throughout the course of his career, and he said he prefers playing on the road. As much as he loves the Cleveland fans, as much as he loves the home court advantage, that adversity gets the most out of him. And Teron Lue said he prefers actually to start a series on the road as well, because it's a feel-out game, and the home team has the pressure to protect that home court. And if you can steal that one, you change the entire series.
We put in a lot of work.
That's enough. Anybody who believes that, give me I mean, sir, anybody believes, I think they prefer, that's Dave McMenamin of ESPN, no disrespect, he's a tremendous reporter, but come on. I think they might prefer to Ty Lue says he prefers to start on the road. It's a feel-out
fans,
game.
As much as he loves the home court advantage, that adversity gets the most out of him, and Tyron Lue said he prefers actually to start a series on the road as well, because it's a feel-out game.
Oh, stop! Oh, anybody who believes that, you know what, stand on your head and spin. Stop. Because if you start in game one on the road, what does that mean? That means you finish, if necessary, in game seven on the road. Nobody prefers to not have home court advantage. I understand you're looking for spin. I understand you're trying to put a positive, take a positive look at things. It's okay. But this is, quite frankly, what my biggest concern was when they were resting guys and when they were not playing any defense down the stretch in the regular season, when they gave up the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. I talked about it every day on this program then, and I said, don't mess around and lose the number one seed to Boston. You don't want that. Now, does this mean I think Boston's going to win the series? Of course not. But let's not be silly here and say it's better to start on the road because, you know, it's a, you know, hostile atmosphere and you test yourself. And you know what? It's a feeling out game in game one anyway, and I prefer to do it on the road. Don't give me that nonsense. It is better to start at home. It's better to finish at home if it comes down to it. And if need be, it's just better to play four instead of three at home. And anybody telling you otherwise is a liar. 866-240-1065 is the number to join us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Let's go to Toledo. And say good afternoon to Don, who wants to talk a little bit about these NBA playoffs. Hey, Don, how are you?
Hey, Bob.
What's going on, man?
I listen to the show a lot. I was just actually going to comment on what you just talked about. Right after the first series, I felt that Cleveland tanked the end of the season on purpose so they could have a closer matchup going to the last week of the season so they could determine if they're one or two. So, with their comments coming out today, I truly believe they just wanted to determine which road they went through the playoffs.
I'm not sure what you mean by which road. Explain that to me, though.
So, like, if they're so they waited until the matchups with like seven or eight who was going to get into the playoffs, were looking. So they looked at it as Chicago and the Wizards, or Indiana and Toronto. And they figured they'd get more rest, probably sweep through like they did, and they flipped the switch, and that was an easier road to the Eastern Conference Finals.
Okay, I guess I can take that somewhat, although I'm sure they would still rather have not been on the road. I mean, if they could find a way to navigate it so they get the matchups that they wanted to make it an easier road to the finals, I don't disagree that maybe they would, you know, consider being able to do that. But I still think they would prefer to do that and have home court. I just, you know, we've seen it so many times in the playoffs. Home court advantage makes a difference. I'm not going to say it accounts for 3 to 4 points a game, but it simply does in terms of atmosphere, in terms of comfort level, in terms of sleeping in your own bed, as opposed to staying in a hotel and dealing with all of the stuff that a road trip entails. It really does matter. And I think they're going to go to Boston and they'll probably be fine. But I think they would be a lot more fine. I think they'd be a lot more comfortable going up 2-0 if they had to do it at home rather than having to do it on the road.
The only thing I was trying to look at it towards the end of the season, the last trip to Boston, they actually played and kicked their butt.
Yep.
And then the last couple of games in the season, they could have actually played and got the number one seed, but they chose the rest.
Right.
So they basically chose number two over number one.
And they actually said that, too. They actually said at the time that the rest means more, it means more to them or is more important to them or something, in that vein than the seeding. And I still feel like they said that just because they did not want to play Kyrie and LeBron and the guys in those final two games. But I still think that, because that's the public stance you have to take. You can't say, we really want the number one seed. It's important to us. By the way, we're sitting our best players. It would be laughed at. It would be like, that's stupid. You either do or you don't, if you're going to play them. But I think if you were to ask them privately, would you like to have rested them and had the number one seed, they damn sure would rather have the number one seed.
Well, I just looked at it as how the first season went and how the second half of the season went. They had to close the gap so they could actually dictate where they're going.
Yeah, yeah, I get it. I get it. And so now that they are where they're going to be, Don, how do you feel about it? You know, they did go to Boston in what a lot of people saw as a statement game in their last trip to Boston, and they beat the dog, you know what, out of them. And a lot of people said, well, that's all that, you know, there is. You know, that's the switch being flipped, if you will. But then, of course, they had those terrible two games back-to-back. They followed up that tremendous all-around performance with the clunker at home against the Hawks, and then they went to Atlanta 2 days later and blew a 24-5-point lead against the Hawks. And at that time, everybody was like, well, so much for the goodwill and the positive momentum generated by that domination of Boston.
But I think that goes back to, as they were trying to set up where they were going, and they were still waiting to see who was going to be the eighth seed and all that stuff, but they wanted that statement game against Boston, showing them they could go there, no matter if we give you the number one or not, we can prove we can play in your building and beat you.
Yeah, and they did. There's no doubt about it. And I'll be honest with you, even though Boston won that series, and so ergo, they must be better than Washington, I think I would have feared isn't the right word. I would have been more concerned about Washington than I am Boston. I feel like they match up worse against a backcourt like Wall and Beal than Bradley Beal than they do against Boston. I feel like Washington would have been a tougher series for them to win or sweep in four or win in five or whatever the case might be.
And I think their Chicago series through the season, I think Chicago beat them.
Yeah, they did.
So that's why I think they chose two over one, because they would have had that matchup of Chicago and the Wizards versus Boston having to go the easier route.
Right, right.
I think that's why they really just wanted to close the gap so they could determine which route they had. And
I got you, my man. Hey, Don, I'm glad you weighed in on hold. Thanks very much for the call, buddy. Appreciate it. All right. There you go, Don in Toledo, 866-240-1065 if you want to get on as well. And don't forget, if you'd rather tweet to us, because you can't wait on hold, you can do it by finding us at Sports Radio 1065. Sports Radio 1065 is our Twitter handle. We'll get your thoughts on the air one way or the other. Speaking of the Wizards and that game last night with the Celtics and the Wizards, I want to follow up on what I started the show with. John Wall's performance last night in the closeout game, in Game 7, even though it was on the road, was one of the all-time clunkers, quite frankly. One of the all-time tank jobs. One of the all-time, choke jobs, laydowns, whatever it is you want to call it, for a guy who is trying to elevate himself into the stratosphere of top three or four point guards in the National Basketball Association. And that's exactly what John Wall has been trying to do. He has been very, very vocal about that, as a matter of fact. He has been, you know, he doesn't like not being named a starter in the All-Star game. He doesn't like not being voted in by the fans to the All-Star game and having to go in as a reserve. He doesn't like not being called first, second, or third team All-NBA, because point guards like Russell Westbrook and Chris Paul and Kyrie Irving and others are taking those spots. He's very vocal about it. Last night was his opportunity to seize the moment and say, I told you. Not only did I tell you, after having a career year, by the way, the best of his career, 23.1 points, 10.7 assists. He was legit all season long. Not only did I tell you that I was this good, now here we are in the Eastern Conference Finals, and I'm going to go out there for the next 4, 5, 6, or 7 games against Kyrie Irving and show you again that I'm better than Kyrie. And you better start putting respect on my name. You better start naming me along with Russell or Harden or CP3 or Steph Curry or Kyrie Irving. You better put my name up there. Last night was his chance to do that in a closeout game. And what did John Wall do? What John Wall did is what many players like John Wall often do. He let an egg when it all mattered the most. Oh, sure, his stat line. Actually, I wouldn't even say, oh, sure. I was going to say his stat line still looks good because it's almost a triple-dub, because he had 18 points, 11 assists, and 7 rebounds. If you just look at those stats in a vacuum, you might say he played pretty well. But let's actually go to the shooting stats. 8 of 23 in 44 minutes. 1 of 8 from 3. And let's break that down a little bit further. When was this game decided? When was it winning time in the second half? In the second half, John Wall, against the Boston Celtics last night, shot 2 for 13 from the floor, and he missed his final, not 5, not 6, not 7, nor 8, not even 9, not even 10. He missed his final 11 shots. So while the Celtics are going down there and taking a lead and padding a lead and getting buckets from the likes of Kelly Olynyk, who had 26 points, what? And 5 rebounds. 26 points in 28 minutes, by the way. Kelly Olynyk, 10 out of 14. That's what John Wall was supposed to do for the Wizards. But while Isaiah Thomas was scoring 29 and Olynyk was scoring 26 and Jay Crowder and Al Horford were doing their thing, and it's time to come back and answer on the other end. John Wall, 0-for-11 in his final 11 shots. Bradley Beal did everything he could. He's supposed to be the backcourt running mate. Bradley Beal is supposed to be the Robin to John Wall's Batman. Bradley Beal is supposed to be the complimentary piece next to the showcase. Bradley Beal showed up. Bradley Beal came to play. Bradley Beal shot 12 of 22. Bradley Beal shot 5 out of 10 from distance. Bradley Beal scored 38 freaking points in a closeout game. 4 rebounds, 2 assists, a couple of steals as well. 9 out of 10 from the line when he needed them. Bradley Beal did what he did his job. John Wall was the reason why the Washington Wizards are going to be watching. They're now the Washington Wizards because they're going to be watching the Cavaliers and the Celtics in the Eastern Conference Finals. Yeah, I'm copywriting that too, the Washington Wizards.
I was going to say, do you want me to apply for the copyright on that?
Damn right I do. I still haven't gotten my official attorney letter saying that I own the rights to 3-match. Well, you know, in the NBA Finals,
mm-hmm.
Pat Riley still has his 3-peat, but nobody has quoted or has copywritten a 3-match, which is
now
what it will be if the Cavaliers and the Warriors face each other for the third straight year in the Finals. So I want my money for that. And I also want Washington, the Washington Wizards. But anyway, you know, Frank, and tell me if you agree with what I said before about Wall trying to say I'm one of the best, and he's been very, very vocal about this, and he really doesn't like the fact that he's not getting enough respect. And he really, in a way, and sometimes, and I'd have to go back. I don't want to accuse anybody falsely, but I want to say I remember at some point in the last year or two,
mm-hmm.
he actually did use Kyrie by name. I feel like there was a point in which he either said Kyrie by name that he's better, or maybe it was when Kyrie was voted into the All-Star game and he wasn't, and he said he should have been the starter, which then of course means, you know, you should have been there over Kyrie because you're both point guards. I don't know exactly, but I feel like he actually, in addition to saying he feels like he should be rated higher among the great point guards
right.
in general, I feel like he may have taken a personal shot at Kyrie at one point. But John Wall, by his flame out last night in Game 7 and also his failure in Game 5, where he also struggled terribly in the fourth quarter, I think he elevated Kyrie Irving much, much more in the pantheon of great current NBA point guards. Kyrie got better by not playing simply because John Wall did what Kyrie Irving doesn't do, and that's fade in the fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Kyrie Irving steps up in the fourth. Kyrie Irving hits championship-winning threes in the fourth. Kyrie Irving goes on 11-point runs personally in the fourth of the Eastern Conference semis against Toronto. Dude lives for the biggest moments that a guy like John Wall apparently shrinks in. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no debating it right now. I mean, he just laid a goose egg in a huge Game 7. The great thing about the NBA playoffs, and actually playoffs in any sport, but especially with the NBA with their emphasis on building up the superstars of the league, well, this is really what separates greatness. Yeah, you can have awesome stat lines coming up into the playoffs, but if you don't get the job done and especially lay an egg like this, are you really great?
Yeah. I mean, and his stats say that he is. And in the regular season, I'm sure he did have some big fourth quarters, so I don't want to say that he never rises to the occasion with a game on the line. But in a Game 7, you know,
yeah.
with a berth in the Eastern Conference Finals against the Eastern Conference point guard that you perhaps have to target more. I mean, am I wrong about that, by the way? Are there other great Eastern Conference point guards besides Kyrie, Isaiah Thomas, who just won last night, and John Wall. Is there anybody else that we can discuss in those terms? Obviously, Reggie Jackson coming off the season he had has just fallen way down in that regard. Jeff Teague, no. Kyle Lowry, I suppose, is another guy.
Yeah.
Kyle Lowry, and of course, he was injured for games 3 and 4 of that Eastern Conference semifinal there. But I'm just trying to think of the rest of the point guards. Let me just look at the standings real quick, and that'll pull up each of the teams. Boston has Isaiah, the Wizards, of course. I just mentioned Kyle Lowry, I should say. The Bucks, no. The Pacers have Teague now, no. Bulls, Heat, Pistons, we covered. Yeah, I don't think there's anybody else that really is in that car. Okay, so the conversation is among three in the Eastern Conference. And I think Isaiah Thomas has passed John Wall. I think Kyrie Irving basically rests atop the Eastern Conference as the best point guard in the conference based on what he has done, not just, you know, I mentioned John Wall has had a career year, statistically speaking, with his 23 points and his 10 assists per game, and clearly he has. But guess what else? I think we could say the very same thing about Kyrie Irving. Kyrie Irving has had his best season, or the best season of his career as well. Kyrie Irving in the post, no, not the postseason. I want to get his regular season stats here if I can for a second. Yeah, 25.2 points per game. Talk about elevating your game this season. Kyrie Irving in his sixth year, a career high 25, which is three better than his second highest, which was in 2012-13 before LeBron came back. 25.2 points, 5.8 assists, which is not quite a career high, but right about there. His highest was 6.1. He shot 47%, which was a career high. He shot 40% from three, which almost tied a career high. He had shot 41% 2 years ago. And obviously in the fourth quarter, he is taking games over, even when that is supposed to be the time when the quote-unquote greatest player on the planet, the king, is the guy who's supposed to take over. When the Cavaliers need a bucket, they don't go to the king. And the king doesn't go to himself most of the time. He finds a way to put it in Kyrie's hand because that dude is flat-out cold-blooded. Am I offending Pistons fans, Frank Gargano, when I say this dude is the new Mr. Big Shot?
I don't think...
Is it accurate?
I think it's totally accurate. I mean, there's really nobody to offend. I mean, we've seen it time and time again. Yeah, Kyrie's the guy who's going to get that shot every time. If he's open and King James needs to close out the game, Kyrie's probably going to be the guy. I mean, you could make the argument that John Wall's still, if you really want to, you could make the argument that he's better than Kyrie, but I don't see it that way. And just one stat I want to look at to...
Well, in what way could you make that argument? You said if you wanted to, you could make the argument that John... In what way? Why, how would you?
You could say that due to having LeBron James on the Cavs, I mean, let's face it, LeBron does elevate the play of everybody else on that court.
No
whereas
doubt.
John Wall, he's the guy. He has to be the one to make everything click.
So you're saying that if John Wall played with LeBron James, he might be actually better than Kyrie?
Could be. I don't know the answer. As of right now, I'd give it to Kyrie, though.
I would, too. And the reason why is what we saw last night. Because the clutch gene, if you can borrow that, you know, use that, he just doesn't seem to have it. I mean, he looked pie-eyed last night. You know, the pupils dilated just, whoom, just way, way too big for the moment. The moment was just way, way too big for him. When it came time to come back down and answer Isaiah, who scored on the other end, he couldn't do it. Answer Kelly Olynyk, he couldn't do it. Answer Avery Bradley, he couldn't do it. Answer Jeff, you know, he came down and tried, and he kept gunning, but he just could not do it, and that is the kind of thing that I think separates, because Kyrie Irving doesn't go on those kinds of cold spells when the money is on the line, when the game is on the line. And I don't care if LeBron James is your teammate or not. Oftentimes, like in that 11-0 run against the Raptors in Game 4, it was Kyrie coming down coast to coast.
Right.
Or at least taking the outlet pass and getting up and then keeping it himself and going and doing his thing, LeBron James not being a part of the play, other than naturally being a focus of the defense. Somebody's got to stay on him, maybe even two. But Kyrie Irving, you know, whether it's going to the basket and finishing with either hand, crossing people over and hitting mid-range jumpers, or pulling back for, you know, the tremendously sweet stroke that he has on a three ball, he, to me, doesn't have pie eyes. He doesn't have that look of, oh, my God, can I do this? He just is calm and casual and does it without that kind of, so that's the kind of thing, what, for me, that LeBron or no LeBron, I think Kyrie has over John Wall. And really, quite honestly, I say, probably over every other point guard in the National Basketball Association, with the potential, possible, maybe exception of Steph Curry. Because Russell Westbrook gets the same look. That's why his fourth quarter shooting, his regular, you know, shooting is not good anyways, around 42% in the fourth quarter, drops to 25%, for crying out loud. He can't do it. He gets a little too crazy, a little bit pie-eyed, a little bit tight, a little bit of tightness around the throat area. We saw James Harden in one of the all-time epic meltdown quit jobs last week. Chris Paul hasn't been there enough to evaluate because he's never been out of the second round. Wall, we just covered. I don't know who else to talk about other than Curry. And Curry, I can't say the same thing about, because he has gone on fourth quarter binges, just like he has gone on binges in other places as well, in the playoffs, and he is a champion. He won it. And that's before KD got there, and he was the central focus as the league MVP. So I would say the only two point guards in the league that have proven to be the fourth quarter man are Kyrie Irving and Steph Curry, and not coincidentally, they're probably going to end up facing one another coming up here in about 2 weeks.
I was going to say, Bob, so what you're saying is bring on the three match.
Yeah, I am. Although it's not really a three match for the two of them, unfortunately, because we know Kyrie had to miss almost the entire finals 2 years ago.
Very true.
Three match between the two clubs, but not for them. That's the reason I had to pause there. So, but yeah, I really, and again, people can say, he's being a homer, but if you can disprove what I said about Westbrook, what I said about Harden, what I said about Wall, what I've said about Isaiah, what I've said about Chris Paul not being there, if you can disprove that and tell me that somebody else is better in those moments than Kyrie Irving and Steph Curry, then please, by all means, do it, because I don't think so. 866-240-1065, just for the hell of it, we got to hear it.
Irving and Curry, one-on-one. Irving puts it up. It's good! Kyrie Irving from downtown! And the Cavaliers by three!
Irving raises up, contested three is up, and good for Kyrie Irving!
Wow.
92-89.
Picked up by Steph Curry. Six to shoot. He's at the right point. He stutter steps. He launches a three. He nailed it! 53 seconds to go. Cavaliers 92. Warriors 89. Irving has 26. Oh, what a clutch shot for the fifth-year man out of Duke.
Several calls there of the Kyrie Irving shot. Remember, that was a part of a series. The block, the shot, the stop. The block of Andre Iguodala, the shot by Kyrie Irving over Steph Curry, the two guys we're talking about right now, and then the Kevin Love, unbelievable defense, all arms and legs, just making life miserable for Steph Curry, who couldn't cross over a seven-footer at the top of the key when he needed to get a good shot off to come back down there and to try to match the Cavaliers. That was just one of the most epic finishes you're ever going to see. And that shot by Irving took, if I may borrow this phrase, just took balls of steel, and dude had him. He just had him. John Wall doesn't. Most of the other guys that I mentioned before, with the exception probably of Curry, they don't, and that's what sets him apart. All right. Hey, get a quick time out of here for about an hour Sports Center. I want you to be a part of it. Dial 866-240-1065. I'm going to talk a little bit also in the next segment about this most bizarre story, one of the strangest things you've ever heard, a lawsuit filed by the son of a former NBA legend, now the late Moses Malone, the son of the Hall of Famer, filing a lawsuit against one of the point guards we're talking about right now, James Harden, in one of the most bizarre stories you're going to hear for a long time. We'll share that with you coming up. Hey, during this quick timeout, as we head to SportsCenter, I want to hook you up with something else. Gave you the Splash Universe before. You know what else I have? I got a pair of tickets sitting right here on the counter. Actually, Frank Argano has it in front of him, but it's on the counter. And it's a pair of tickets to see WWE SmackDown at the Huntington Center 1 week from today, next Wednesday, May 23rd. If you want to go see SmackDown, we're going to set you up. Caller number 8, caller number 8 to 866-240-1065. You will go enjoy the WWE at the Huntington Center next Tuesday, and we're back right after.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Back indeed, final segment of the afternoon. Just 17 minutes of outstanding awesome left for you before drive time comes your way with Mr. Mike Miller. Frank Argano, I'm going to let you call the shot here. I was a little bit torn. Actually, I wasn't before, but I am now. I was I kind of announced before the end of the last segment there that we're going to go ahead and talk about the Moses Malone Jr. and James Harden legal saga, which is just one bizarre tale, to say the very least. But the other part of me now, I kind of became torn because I really kind of want to talk about Eddie Lacy as well. Which of these two bizarre stories do you think we should discuss here in the final segment?
See, I feel like with the Harden one, it's more of like a legal case. I feel like we don't really know all the facts to it, but to Eddie Lacy we do. And that one's pretty, I just still can't believe it.
To that end, I agree in what you said.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that we necessarily need to know all the legal facts of the Moses Malone Jr. James Harden case to make it interesting, because it's the accusation itself is what makes it interesting.
Right.
Maybe we can do both briefly. For those who don't know, Moses Malone Jr. is the son of the obvious NBA legend Moses Malone, one of my favorite players of all time, period. One of the most underrated centers in the history of this league. When we talk about the great centers, we talk about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, probably the greatest of all, six-time NBA champion, all-time scoring leader, etc. We talk about Wilt, the scoring phenom, 50 points a game, 26 rebounds a game. We talk about Russell, the all-time champion with 11 titles. We talk about Shaq. We talk about Ewing. We talk about Hakeem the Dream, two-time champion. And if there's others, and I'm sure there are, that's fine. Never does anybody mention the name Moses Malone, which drives me crazy. And I'm getting off the subject here. This is what I do. I chase squirrels whenever I see them. That's what ADHD does. But Moses Malone, to me, one of the greatest all-time centers that nobody ever talks about, and I don't know why. Three-time MVP himself, NBA champion 1983, ABA legend. Maybe that's why sometimes the ABA guys, you know, lose some seasons in the early part of their career. So their all-time numbers don't stack up with others who started out in the NBA. But at any rate, Moses Malone Jr. filed an amended lawsuit yesterday, seeking damages from NBA superstar and probable MVP runner-up. That's my guess, even though I would have voted for him after the regular season ended. James Harden, for allegedly orchestrating a beatdown of Moses Malone Jr. last summer. You know, I heard this story, Frank, and I thought, oh my God, James Harden is living out in real life what I do on the radio. Because I used to do... On another show I did, I used to do a segment called Who Deserves a Beating Today? And I would just highlight all of the, you know, jackwads in the sports world or in the news or whatever who just deserve beatdowns. And I had a special beating sound effect that I would play, and we would just deliver this, you know, this audio justice, if you will.
Oh,
because
man.
We certainly wouldn't do it physically, you know.
Right.
It's just an audio version of a stuff like this.
You know.
And occasionally mix in a little bit of Stewie. No, that's not it. Hold on, where are you, Stewie?
Oh. Yeah.
You got
that's
my money?
Happens, man. Oh my God! Yeah, that's what happens. Yeah, you like that? That feel good? That feel good? Yeah, that hurt? That hurt?
What the hell?
Yeah, it feels so good, does it? No, huh?
Psychopath.
Clean yourself up.
One of the greatest on animated beatings, I think, in the history of television. Can we agree on that?
I'd say the greatest. I'm biased because Family Guy is probably my favorite show ever, but
well,
still.
If you're biased toward Family Guy, though, do you then not have to consider Peter and the Chicken?
See.
Because in this one that I just played three different clips of, because it lasted that long, it was Stewie just beating Brian to a bloody pulp. I think at one point he pulled a flamethrower on him.
He does. He shoots him in the knee, pulls out a flamethrower, and lights him on fire.
So it's just a straight-up one-man beatdown of another. In Peter and the Chicken, it's mutual. It's dual. It's a battle to a draw, but it's drawn out so much longer. Literally, they fight for like 6 minutes on screen.
Right.
Every single possible venue that there is, you know, from streets to, I think at one point, do they end up on a rocket on another planet or something stupid and then land back on Earth? that one is not as much of a single beatdown as it is just a brawl between the two. So maybe if I say the single best animated beatdown ever, you'd probably have to go Stewie, yes?
Absolutely. Especially, I think what makes it so good is you don't expect it. And Stewie and Brian are the duo, the best friends of the show, even though they try to say that they hate each other. And Nobody saw it coming. Yeah. That's what made it so good.
Yeah, I think you're right. Anyway, I'm getting off in the weeds chasing scores here. But I used to do a thing called Who Deserves a Beating Today, and I would play. And we, you know what, we may start that back up on the Extravaganza.
I'm surprised you haven't, especially with all the talk about Draymond Green and Kevin Durant's press conferences. I'm really shocked you haven't brought it.
Well, you know what, we may just have to bring it back. We'll have to build a little intro to it and get our music bed going.
We'll figure it out.
We will, because in the way it works, by the way, for those listening, it isn't just me deciding who gets beat down. I would the way I did it on my previous shows, I would take your call. And you tell me who you want to beat the living crap out of, proverbially and audio only, of course. I would never, of course, endorse beating anybody physically in reality. This is just an audio beatdown. But who do you want to beat down? And you would call me and say Zaza Pachulia for what he did to Kawhi Leonard. You know, Draymond Green for what he did. Mark Cuban for what he said. You understand the point. And people would call up and just to give their beatdowns, and we'd take care of them for them. So, to that end, again, here's James Harden in real life. Who deserves a beating? Moses Malone Jr. Why? Because he criticized me on Facebook. That's the story here. James Harden allegedly orchestrated a beatdown of Moses Malone Jr. in retaliation for a Facebook post that offended James Harden, according to Malone's attorney, George Farah. Malone was beaten and robbed of his jewelry by four armed men at about 2 a.m. June 25th last summer outside V Live in Houston, an after-hours strip club. It's a great place to be at 2 o'clock in the morning. All kinds of good things happen there, right? that's wonderful judgment. And there's no place I'd rather be at 2 a.m. than outside a strip club in Houston. All kinds of great things happen there. Nobody ever gets robbed. Nobody ever gets beaten. Nobody ever gets gonorrhea. It's all positive there at a strip club at 2 a.m. Anyway, four men were arrested in connection with the assault, including a guy named Darian Blount, or Blunt, depending on how you pronounce it, a security guard at the now-closed club and charged with aggravated robbery with a deadly weapon. The lawsuit alleges Harden was at the club at the time of the attack. Harden was not charged or accused of wrongdoing in the case criminally, but the lawsuit, civil lawsuit, filed by Malone, says that Blount was acting on the orders of defendant James Harden when he and his associates attacked Malone. The suit alleged that Harden paid Blount approximately $20,000 to put a hit on Malone. The Facebook post in question was published by Malone on June 23rd, so just 2 days before, and it criticized Harden for running a basketball camp for kids. Well, what's so bad about that? Well, the fact that, according to the story, Harden charged $249 for the basketball camp. Moses Malone Jr., again, son of Moses, the legend from Houston. Remember, he was a legend with the Rockets before he went and won a title with the Sixers. Moses Malone Jr. went on Facebook and criticized Harden, saying $249 for a basketball camp. What's the matter with you? You're shutting out every poor inner-city kid that might be interested in coming. Harden, according to this lawsuit, didn't take kindly to that. He was very upset about the post, and that's why he ordered his friends to take a little piece out of Moses Malone Jr., kind of as retribution for this Facebook thing. So that's the story there. James Harden playing a real-life version of my radio game show, Who Deserves a Beating Today? And the answer to him, according to the lawsuit, was indeed Mr. Moses Malone Jr. There you go. That's for you, Moses. Now, by the way, if this is true, I like James Harden is what I'm trying to say. And if this is true, there will not be words to describe how I feel about him. That's unbelievable. That is beyond reprehensible. First of all, to be so offended about a Facebook post that is accurate is just beyond the pale. Can't even imagine it. Second of all, to order somebody else to do your dirty work for you rather than confronting Moses Malone Jr. yourself, man to man, face to face, beard to chin. You know, it's just cowardly in ways that I can't say. And I know this isn't a criminal trial, but I'll say this. If this civil suit is settled and Harden has to pay money to Malone Jr., which to me means he's guilty, or if they actually take it to a jury, and a jury awards Malone the verdict, and James Harden is guilty in a civil trial, then guess what? The NBA has to act. The NBA would have to act and hand out a serious, serious suspension to James Harden, because that is conduct that simply cannot be tolerated by a member of the league, let alone one of its feature stars. So that's the Malone and Harden story. Now to the Eddie Lacy story, which is a little bit more simple to explain, but even much, much harder to understand. Eddie Lacy, the running back, now with the Seahawks, formerly with the Packers, just earned a $55,000 bonus from the Seahawks. What did he do to earn this, you ask? Did he just run for his 1,000th yard in the season? Is it a performance-based bonus?
Nope.
No. What did he do to earn $55,000? He simply made himself a little less fat than he was before. Right?
No, that's the best part is...
You laugh, but that's what it
no,
is.
No, I know. That's the best thing about this story, and I couldn't believe it when I read it. He got paid extra money, not just, you know, some chump change. It's not like some dude on the team was like, yo, I bet you $200 you don't make weight. This is a serious $55,000 bonus for not being too fat.
A $55,000 bonus for coming in at under 255 pounds at his mandatory weigh-in yesterday. He weighed 253, and so they gave him 55 G's. Now, I don't know how much his contract is worth, you know, his actual season salary, but, you know, it's going to be pretty hefty. Oh, here it is. One-year deal for $2.865 million. There it is. So he gets $2.865 million in the one-year contract. He can earn an additional 2.6, almost double, through incentives, including the weight clause. So this is the bottom line. Pete Carroll's bragging about this, by the way. He told a Seattle talk show, he looks awesome. He looks great. He's huge. He's going to continue to play huge. I think he means muscularly, obviously. Now, he's got another weigh-in coming up on August 1st. He has to be at 250 by then. And he'll be weighed once a month from September through December, and he has to weigh 245 or less in each of those to earn more bonuses. His contract allows him to earn 7 potential weight bonuses worth a total of, are you ready for this? $385,000 just to not be too fat to run the football. Now, I'm not kidding. That's what it is.
The best part is don't be too fat. Not just be in shape, but don't, hey, you weren't extremely fat, so here's 50 grand. Somewhere out there, Jamarcus Russell is sitting on the couch going, damn, I wish I still played.
I mean, honestly, is that not his job? Isn't it his job just for the $2.8 million he signed for to be in shape to play running back? How the hell do you have to pay somebody extra on top of what you're already paying them for, you know, to be a running back? How do you pay them extra just to be in the right shape that it takes to do that job that costs $2.8 million? How do you get extra money just for doing what you're supposed to do? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like you showing up for work today, Frank Gargano.
Yeah.
You have a salary. This is how much Cumulus Media pays you to do your job on a weekly or a biweekly basis. But by the way, you came in on time 4 times this week. Here's a bonus for doing what you were supposed to do.
No, it would be better. You were 5 minutes late, but you weren't too late. So here's some money.
That's even better. Instead of being 15 minutes late, you were 5 minutes late.
Great job.
Well done. As an incentive to be even closer to being on time next time, here's a bunch of money. I mean, honestly, you think you can negotiate that?
Oh, yeah.
No call question. Our boy Billy Michaels and see if we can get that written into your next contract. And by the way, I think I'm going to get it into mine as well. 50 grand just for not being fatter. Well done, Eddie. And by the way, whoever his agent is, I'm
round
hiring
of applause.
Him tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
I want that guy on my side negotiating all of my contracts. All right, that's it. That's all the time we've got. Chew on that one for a little while you're waiting for Mike Miller. Drive time is coming on. Oh, by the way, hey, congrats to Keith Dolinsky of Toledo. Keith won the WWE tickets. Guess what? I got more. I'll give you those away tomorrow. Drive time's coming up next. We'll see you.